simple thing. This morning, it was a little cool. And now, since the radiator, I've been working all morning, possibly we're going to be hot. But then, it was cold, and did we say, oh, I am cold. I am always cold. I mean, you know, I can never warm myself up. And then we can identify, oh, I am always hot. I can never be cool enough, or whatever. It's just like they are experiencing, they are conditions, and then we can creatively engage with it. Or we can really restrain, reduce our experience through the identification. So this afternoon, I wanted to go a little more on it. First, I wanted to talk about an research. This is some people in America were trying to do some research on the effect of meditation on the brain. I mean, they were doing that. At the same time, they're trying to, now there is some research on what is a natural state of the brain and how can you see that in the fMRI. And then they wanted to make a comparison between the natural restful state of the brain and the natural restful state of the brain in people who had meditating for a long time and see the difference, etc., etc. And so this is a preliminary kind of conclusion in the middle of the research. And what they found out, first, what people have found out recently, is that actually the natural restful state of the brain, for most people, is not restful. So actually, when you are supposedly in the natural restful state of the brain, actually your mind thinks quite a lot. And that's why actually it's hard to have a measure. What is this measure against what? But then, when they try to measure, you know, the difference in the meditator between their natural state and their meditative state, and between other people, etc., etc., what they found is that the people who had meditated for a long time, actually, the natural restful state of the brain were restful. Because what they realized is that there was a whole level of thinking that was not there. So it did not mean that they were not able to think. I mean, they would be in the machine and they would be able to be, I am conscious, I am in this machine, and whatever. So what I found interesting when I read this interim report was that I experienced that too. That a lot of a level of thinking which I used to have many years ago are not there. And what I think goes, that whole level of unrestful, supposedly restful state of the brain, I think a lot of it is actually selfing, self-referencing, which actually is not so necessary. The thing is that sometimes we think, the more I think, the more I am, the more I exist. And I think with the meditation, we can be becoming aware that we can still think in a wise, compassionate way, being aware of people, engaging with them in a skillful way. But there is a whole lot of level of thinking we don't need. And to me, that's what I find interesting about identity. Are we all the thought which describe us, which comment on what is going on? Or are we this complex human being who is formed by these different things, and part of it is being able to think. And then what I would call creative functioning of the brain, in a way, with the creative functioning of the heart, of the body, and meeting the environment. And so it seems to me that, in a way, part of the meditative process is that disappearing of a certain level of selfing which is not so useful. And if we look at that level of selfing, that it be with the thought or with the emotion or the way we relate to sensation, is part of it, is actually be some kind of self-referencing or other referencing or certain type of looking at the self, thinking of the self, commenting on the self, which actually might not be so necessary. And to say it in a simple way is nearly like asking the question, what do I think about myself? Or what do other people think of me? How do they look at me? How do I look at myself? And so it's kind of like a level of self-questioning or self-referencing, which actually might not be so essential. I'm not saying that reflecting on action and seeing, oh yeah, with awareness, I did this and that happened, and I did this and this happened. That is, I would call, the creative functioning of reflection. A creative ability we have. But to be constantly wondering, am I doing the right thing? Am I doing the wrong thing? Are they thinking this way about me? Are they not thinking this way about me? I mean, I know some people, it's kind of like they have this kind of nearly triple, quadruple loop, thinking, she thinks this, and if she thinks this, then it must be that, and if it's like that, then it must be that, when actually the person is not thinking this whatsoever. But you could go like lots of identification, lots of kind of identity, which have nothing to do with the experience. That it be your experience, or that it be the other person's experience. So in a way, I feel through the meditation, I would say we can do this in two ways. One way is a natural disappearance over time. Like each time we come back to the breath, each time we're not feeding that unnecessary selfing. That I think is an important function of anchoring. It's coming back to the breath again and again. And through that, you come back to the creative functioning of the organism instead of feeding that kind of unnecessary selfing. And also when we inquire, when we use vipassana, when we meditate, we are questioning the solidity of that selfing, of that self-referential history, description, commenting. And instead of, in a way, living, describing ourselves to ourselves, just living, just experiencing, without the need to describe it, to make it more possibly existing. I don't know. That, in a way, is for us. To me, this is why it's an exploration. It's for us to find out. Because I think we might, at some level, be the same. At another level, we are a little different. And so the question is also, how do I construct my identity? And do I construct it in a way which is helpful? Or do I construct it possibly in a way which is not very helpful? And do I cause suffering to myself and to others? Here recently I read a book which was really, very interesting. And it was by somebody called Sue Meek. I'm sorry, the title I've totally forgotten. It might come back to me or not. And the story is about one of a rare, rare case of total memory loss of identity. It's very rare to have this kind of called retrograde something, and then she had also problem in the future. So she was ordinary young woman, married, children, etc., 20 years old or something around that. And she has an accident, some kind of something hit her brain, and in the 80s. And she wakes up and she does not remember who she is, where husband is, the children, nothing. She doesn't remember anything. She also doesn't really remember what things mean, what things are, what, you know, what eating means, what a spoon means. But she stays in the hospital a bit and they kind of can learn. The forward memory is not so damaged quite a bit, but not so bad that she cannot relearn what a spoon is, what to eat is, and everything like this. And so it's in the days or where she is where they don't take too much care of, you know, they think she should be okay and they don't do very much with it. So she goes back home and then she lives on. But what is interesting reading her book is that, you know, people see her friends, her family, and they can see this is physically the same person. She looks the same person. But actually, she's not the same person because she does not react in the same way. And so you have these kind of weird things where actually they like her better. Emotionally, she's much more calm because she doesn't really know what's going on. So, you know, it's kind of, she's trying to cope as best as she can within the situation. And so at one level, people think, oh wow, she's so much nicer. She's easier to deal with, much calmer, much, you know, less agitated, and more introverted, less extroverted. Oh, that's, you know, nice, you know. Before she got into all kind of trouble, now she's not into trouble anymore. And so she has people describing how she was before, and her not being able to identify at all with the person she was before, because for her it's totally nothing. And at the same time, she is this person. And what does she become? How can she identify? And so you see over the book, how slowly and with lots of difficulty, she kind of, you know, slowly re-emerged as an identity. And you obviously see some of the things from before are still there underneath in some way. And then she created this new person, so to speak. But I thought this was fascinating, but in terms of identity, oneself, our identity, but also in terms of the identity other give us, because there, generally, you know, people are reaffirming us, who we are, because you are the same person, oh yes, I love you, and you like this, and you know, generally people reaffirm us. And here you had this kind of like, you know, they were reaffirming or questioning, and she was like, she did not have this invalidation that generally we have from others. And so it's kind of looking at also our identity. Is it sometime resting on others' view of us? Like recently I saw a picture of myself, age 22, just before I shaved my head and become a nun. I had never seen that picture. And when I saw it, I could not recognize myself, insofar that I had not a feeling of identity. So who is this? I mean, obviously it looks slightly like me with the glasses and, you know, the right shape and fit. But I had no feeling, this is me, that I knew this person. When everybody said, oh yeah, yeah, that's Marty. Well, they could recognize me. I could not recognize somebody, but I could not feel this was me. When I have a picture of about a year earlier, who looks like the photo I have already seen of me at that time, and then I recognize myself. And then I thought, that's what I kind of wonder sometimes if when we, nowadays there are lots of selfies, you know, selfies is a big thing. But with the selfies, I think, you know, part of it is, you know, affirming our identity. Recognizing our identity, or the identity we want to create nowadays, you can improve the selfies too. You know, you have lots of hacks to improve your selfie, so you get a better identity. And then also how other people, when they say, you know, they like your photo, you know, they affirm you.
your identity. And then if you don't get any likes, no, that was not the right identity. You know, I have to improve that selfie or whatever it is.
But you see, in a way, it's, we build the identity from, in, of course, inward, but also from outward. And if you think, you know, as a child, you're kind of always kind of looking at for your mother. I mean, does she look like what you're doing is the right thing to do? And then if you will, that's okay. Or does she look at you and it's the wrong thing to do, but you still do it anyway because you want to do it. But so it's kind of in a way other people actually seems to be telling you what is right, what is wrong. And then I think of course it's useful as a guide, but I was thinking, but what if our sense of what is good within us is residing in somebody else? That in a way, only if somebody says to me, oh, you are a good teacher, then I feel I am a good teacher. Or do I think by myself, I am a good teacher? Or is it between two persons? That between me and the other person, because I mean, if I am a teacher and nobody comes to my talks, then you could make the slight assumption, either they're not interested, either, you know, you're not a good one or whatever it is. I mean, I have a friend who wanted to be a teacher so much he wanted to be a teacher. But he would never could find people who wanted to be taught by him. It was very strange, but you could feel he wanted to have that identity as a teacher. But then, you know, if you're a teacher, you need to have students, otherwise you cannot get to teach the void, possibly. So that's the thing, where do we get the identity? Part of it we give ourselves. Part of it comes also from the outside. If you're working in an office and everybody say you're doing a good job, then you feel, yes, I'm doing a good job. But you could also be doing a good job, and you could have somebody keeping telling you you're doing a bad job. I mean, then you have a problem here, because you feel, do I believe my own identity, I'm doing a good job? Or do I believe the other who said I'm not doing a good job? And I think that sometimes that's where it's kind of like, you don't know sometimes. And I think that's where, in a way, the mindfulness we're trying to develop is so that we become clearer at that level. Am I really doing such a fantastic job? I mean, yes or no, I think it's kind of then we can explore it. Or am I doing such a terrible job? So in a way, we don't take it for granted. I think the meditation helps us to explore what are the different conditions. And so to try to see that actually it can be complicated. In a way, how much do my identity reside in my own potential, in my own giving to myself that identity? How much does it rest on other people, giving me my sense of identity? And I think it's both. I think at one level it's very important that we give ourselves our own sense of identity. That I think is very important. And also very important that it doesn't just rest on something just outside of yourself. Because if there is nobody outside, what are you going to do? Not have any identity? Because they reside just out there. My husband, Stephen Batchelor, he's English. And he went to school in England. And although now he's relatively well known and he has written many books, some books which are even on some university curriculums in America. Actually, he was very bad at school. And when he left school, I think he only had one of the things you need here, either O or A level. No, and he only had one of these. But actually, it was a good one, because he got only one of these in French, which came in very handy. And when he so when he left at the end of, you know, they're leaving school and they're going to go to university, they can make it. Him with only his one A or O level could not do very much with it. At the end, they had this little ceremony where the headmaster shakes hands with all of them. So he shakes hands with this fellow, Stephen Batchelor, and he tells him, "Batchelor, you will never amount to much." So here you could have this is a strong statement about the identity of somebody. And actually, it did not prove to be right, since finding the right condition, which was to become a monk in the Tibetan tradition in Dharamsala, he went on to do quite a very complicated study, very complicated memorizing, and now he's the Stephen Batchelor who is questioning everything, but that's another story. So here you could have, I think this is often also with the parents, also with the culture, that we can be defined. You know, if you don't fit a certain model, you can be defined as not fitting a certain identity. The identity of a good mother, the identity of a good husband, the identity of a good worker, the identity. I mean, there are so many identities floating about. And then we have that identity, and then there is the idea about it, the idea about I should fit it, the idea how other people view us. And that's always tricky, I think, identity, because I think, as Stephen said, as the title of one of his books, we are alone with others. So at one level, we need others, unless we are the kind of person who really don't need others. That's possible. But most of the time, we are with others. We need others. And actually, at one level, others really nurture our identity. That's why there is this whole theory of how the child attached to the mother and the father, and et cetera, et cetera. And that's all that, how that build actually the not only the identity, but actually the brain. As you talk to others, you build up the brain and you build up all kind of things. As I was doing some training, and one of the things that I was really shocked by was when I was told that with the children, that if you really leave children with very little stimulation, then actually some part of the brain will not develop. And it's very hard later. I mean, you can still kind of help them, but it won't be as possibly as good as if it had been done, you know, between the age of one, of 0 to 3. And so this lady, a social worker, was telling her the story of this kid not stimulated until the age of 4 or 5. And I was thinking, you know, like your identity and what you could develop in terms of identity just because of that, because nothing had been done. Because you have not been able to interact with your environment. So the environment, others, are quite determining in terms of our identity. So then, I think being conscious of that, how can I make this, the fact that I'm sharing the world with others, the world with an environment, I can have this creative. So that also being with others can become also part of developing this creative, spacious, wise, compassionate identity. And I think this is interesting how we are with others. And then to look, we aspire to be with others, but do we expect something from others in terms of what they're going to give to our identity? That, you know, I mean, one of the things which was very interesting for me when I was in Korea is that personally, as a French person, and this was in the 70s, I could not wait for anybody I shared the room with to go so that I could have space and I could be myself. So my sense of identity felt better when nobody was around, or less of them around to share the room, so that I could do things my way. I mean, identity is also about how we want things, how you want washing up. I mean, when people, guests, come to my house, I instruct them in the way to wash up. Because I notice they're not always so ecological. So I have a little, you know, I say, I'm sorry, but... I mean, I could let them do their way, that's true. But then possibly they might use lots of soap and lots of water, and then I get, woo! So you literally, the identity there. So, you know, you have your identity, but you also have the way you do things, which becomes part of our identity. And so in Korea, I could see our identity, the Westerner at the time, where like needed a lot of space to feel comfortable with others. But the Korean were the opposite at the time. Because they were saying, oh, you're all on your own, this must be terrible, you know, you need others to feel better. And I thought, don't worry, you know. I'm enjoying this. And for them, they needed to have others so that their identity could really feel, you know, good. And now this is changing. Because this was in the 70s. Now they're becoming modern. They're becoming individualistic. And even the monks are becoming individualistic. Now they need rooms. Because before they would share a room, all of them. And now actually it becomes a bit complicated. Monks need more rooms, so they're still ready to share them, but we've not 20 people anymore. Now they have kind of, you know, two or three possibly. So it's interesting. Our identity also shifts with the culture, but also with the changing of the culture. But then there is also, I think, something we can look at in terms of identity is how we identify others. And that, I think, is really something to me in terms of daily life to really work on. How do we view others? How do we view others' identity? And how often we really fix it? And we kind of, in a way, decide they are like that or they're not like this. I mean, recently, I mean, nowadays there is a lot of talk about autism and children who are autistic. And recently, and there is different people saying different things about it, but recently I read a book by a translation. It's called Why I Jump. And it's basically a young Japanese, 16 years old autistic child who cannot really communicate but found another way with the therapist to communicate. And he explains from inside how it feels to be him. And what is fascinating is that what he says is very different than what you might think when you see it. Because when we see somebody, we assume something very quickly. And so he says, why I jump? It's because it soothes me. That's why I jump. Why I speak very loudly is because there is something within me which is uncontrollable and suddenly takes over and anything goes when that takes over. And what he says is, please see me as a human being with a potential. Don't give up on me. And I was so touched by that he is aware that actually he is difficult, and then people can see his identity as difficult and in a way give up on the human being which has a potential. And he's saying twice, he says it, don't give up on me. I am a human being too. I have a potential. I have feeling. And so in a way is to see that we can so easily categorize. I think identification often, of course, it's a survival mechanism. Well, this person is a safe person, this person is not safe, or this person is dangerous, this person is not dangerous. So
I think we have this very quick feeling of identity, so that we kind of know what is dangerous, what's not dangerous through evolution. We need to know that. But I think from that, then comes this too much this solidification of the identity of others. And so you can do that with children, that, you know, they like this, and this is it. I mean, there is another book I read, which I was just amazed. It's called Far From the Tree, and it's by Solomon. And he wrote a very important book about depression many years before. And here he talks about children who are born different and who are not what the parents expect. So they're not the ideal child or not even the normal child. And so he looks at all the different type of children you can have. And one category he look at is children who are born who look like really, they really have nothing. They don't seem to be able to speak. They often don't have arms or legs, or they're really, really, really restricted in many, many ways. And of course, with these children, it's hard to communicate because you really, you don't, you know, you have this being, but what is this being? And so you had such a person who ended up in an orphanage because the parents could not take care of her. And terrible orphanage, but then she was saved by a therapist who found a way to, so that she could express herself. And what was amazing is that this person who really seemed to be able to do nothing, and then you would assume from that she was nobody and she had nothing, actually was extremely intelligent and very perceptive all throughout. Her brain, her mind, her heart was working. It's not because she did not have all the attributes to make it apparent to everybody that it was so. And so she kind of then started, could be an advocate for people in this kind of situation, saying it's not because we look like we cannot do anything or think anything or anything, that we actually can't. And that she wrote her autobiography and went on to do some, actually, some study and things like that. And to me, it really shows that it's so easily, we can so easily think the person is like this, the person is like that, and then think they will not change. Of course, it can look like, you know, we seems to have a tendency to do the same thing repeatedly. But it doesn't mean that we're stuck, and that we will do this forever. And to me, part of, in a way, the compassion we develop in meditation is actually that whenever we think about ourselves or we think about others, we actually see the potential in the person to grow. Because, like for the person Sue Meek, I mean, she really was really disabled by what happened to her. And it took her ages to finally kind of trigger that she could learn something, that there was a point in learning something. The concept kind of took us a long time to understand the concept of learning and study and things like that. But once she got the concept of learning, then she thought, oh, maybe I could do it. And then it was much harder for her than anybody else, but she could do it. And she was able to have a BA, et cetera, et cetera. So it's kind of like, if you think to yourself or others, that's all I can do, then in a way, you kind of, in a way, solidifying the identity. I mean, it doesn't mean that you might not be stopped from doing something because of your limited circumstances. But it doesn't mean you cannot have a potential within that to be a human being with creative potential. So I think it's really kind of to look at, when I am relating to somebody, am I fixing their identity? Or am I relating to this person but also to the potential they could have, the potential they can have in this moment, the potential they can have in the future. And to me, if we do this, I think it doesn't mean that the person or ourselves are going to change fast. I think we have to be careful here. It's not because you have the potential that you can necessarily, here we go. Sometimes it can change very fast. And sometimes it takes a long time to change, to transform an identity. But to see that at some point, there is a potential. And so it's back to seeing that there are different conditions. The inner condition meeting the outer conditions. And so trying to see how can I creatively engage with my inner condition meeting the outer condition, but also when we meet somebody else, let it be a tree, an animal, a person, can we creatively engage and see that that person could also have a creative identity? I mean, they might not have one now. Sometimes we are very stuck. And we might be stuck for a bit. I think we have to see that on certain things we can see. I mean, so hopefully through the meditation it will help you to have a more creative, more open identity, and you can see how it can blossom in a way. But also to see that sometimes it's like there are little knots in our identity. And then it's interesting to see, is a knot because of me? Is a knot because of them? Is a knot because of society? And to see, can I, in a way, play around? See, how is it possible to untie the knot? Is it possible to make it a little lighter? So it's kind of like trying to see how can we be with that, which seems to me is a very important part of ourselves, of how we meet the world, how we are in the world. But also, in a way, looking at what do we think we need enough to have identity? Because sometimes we can fix our identity with things which exist. So, for example, we exist more if we have a job, if we have a house, if we have a partner. For some people, if you don't have children, if you have or don't have holidays, for some people also, but you have, if for some people you have or not fame, many things, which if I have it, I have, like, you know, good identity. But then we can identify negatively with not having something. So then it's like feeling like your identity, something is missing. I mean, if you have a job and a lot of your identity go into your job, what nowadays, you know, jobs are coming and going a little bit, it sounds like. What if you lose your job? Do you disappear? Do you not exist anymore because you don't have a job? Or sometimes when people retire, it's like, what am I now when I'm retired? So in a way, it's interesting. Often, the identity is very much together with the activity. If I am active, I have an identity. I mean, what do you do when you meet somebody? What's the first thing you ask? What do you do? And then you can know where they are. You know, they are a social worker, they are a nurse, they are a writer. And then you have somebody who says, oh, I am unemployed. And then you think, oh, poor thing. You know, I mean, poor thing, I mean, if they really are financially, et cetera, of course. And so it's good to have a little safety net so they can financially be okay. But Do our identity reside only in having a job, a house, a person? Of course, it helps identity. I totally agree, you know, to have a house, a job, etc. It helps identity, of course. But if we just put it there, it's kind of a little limited. Because, I mean, as the Buddha says, things are impermanent. So if it goes, what are you then? I mean, I have a friend who has just finished research and writing a book on Buddhist nuns. So she went to see Buddhist nuns in Burma, in Nepal, in America, in England. And often there is this idea that the nuns, often there is this weird idea that, you know, women become nuns. Not monks. They become monks because they're going to be great Buddhas. But women, they become nuns because, you know, they have a problem with a boyfriend or, you know, the thing like that. You know, bad love story. Generally, that's what you think. Often people think, or because they want to get out of the world or whatever. Or there is something wrong with them. They become nuns. And what is wonderful in that book, which should appear next year, is that she found all these different types of nuns. And what you see, they become nuns actually because they really question actually the identity. Often this is very interesting. Because you have some nuns who have everything. They have a good job, they have a good boyfriend, they have everything. And they think, but is all there is to it? And in a way, they want something more. It's very interesting. They want something more. And they become nun. Or some of them, they become nun because they have had somebody dies or somebody becomes ill. And they really kind of become aware of impermanence. And because of that, they think, you know, what is the most important things to do? To build identities through things or actually to be and really explore being and then trying to share that with others. And so it's really interesting to see actually about identity there. Because, I mean, as a nun, at one level, your identity most of the time is not very high in a lot of these countries. It's improving slowly, but they're not. So they're not becoming nun to get a wonderful identity, in a way. But actually they do. By becoming nun, they really become who they can be as human beings. And they really blossom. And that's what I could see in Korea. Now it's changing again. But when I was there 30 years ago, 40 years ago, you could see that a lot of the women became nuns to become who they could be, to have an identity actually separate. Because in Korea, it was very traditional before. As a woman, you were either the daughter of a man, the wife of a man, or the mother of a man. And that's what your definition. And your other identity was an inside person. And the man was an outside person. That's where your identity was. And whenever this kind of identity did not kind of make you think, great, I love this, then actually they would become none. Because then they could become themselves. They could have their own identity, not determined in relationship to a man. Now it's different because things are changing, becoming modern. But it's interesting. Again, where does reside our identity? That it be culturally, because I think culture can have a lot with it. When I stopped being a nun, and I mean being a Western nun in Korea, it gave me a good identity. You know, I am one. The one Buddhist French nun among 120 million people, I mean. I had a good identity. But when I stopped being a nun, poof, it was like, hey, wait a minute, where is it? No? And then I had to find a job, but I have never been to university. So I became a house cleaner. And so the first time I was told I could become a house cleaner, my heart sang, my identity went, whoop, you know. I used to be a fancy nun. Now I'm... And then I became a house cleaner. And actually, I thought, this is really a good job. You know, it's good practice. And that's why I really kind of now I look at house cleaner in a very different way. I think they should be well paid, better paid than they are. They work well. So it's again, you know, where does your identity reside? How do you make your own identity? And you don't define it by the certain definition of the culture. I think that's something also to look at. And my final story will be a Twitter story and a Facebook. So I am on Facebook, and last year I did a very interesting talk about internet, mindfulness, with somebody else who was a Twitterati also. And before that, I was interviewed by a young woman. And in the middle of the discussion about internet and different things and mindfulness, she said to me, you know, how many likes do you have? I said, you mean like, I said, when I put a picture, I get a few likes. She said, no, how many likes do you have? So I understood that it was my fan page. You see, if I had a fan page, how many people liked my fan page? So I said, well, I don't know, you know. So we went to look. And then my fan page, I think, then I had possibly 750 likes. And she said, oh, I have more! And she was so happy that she had, I don't know, 900 or something likes, you know. And she was this young little Dutch journalist, and I was this big famous thing, and she was at more likes than me. So that she got a boost to her identity. But does your identity reside in the likes you get or the retweet you get? So that's what I wanted to say. So maybe we can just stand, do standing meditation.